On radio. On radio. More of the good stuff. CliffCentral.com. Stay informed and up to date. It's the Daily Maverick Show. Tuesdays, 1 to 2 p.m. on CliffCentral.com.
Good afternoon, it's 1.06 p.m. and you're tuned in to the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. My name is Kingsley Kipuri and I'll be your host for the next hour. We'll be unpacking some of the top news stories from around the country and around the continent. Now, I'm joined with a very, very esteemed panel here. I'm very excited to have you all here.
No one has ever used those word in to describe us before.
The shock and awe on their faces.
Not in my presence.
So first up, we have a guest, our Daily Maverick contributor, Gashwell Brooks. Welcome to the show. Perfect. And we have Daily Maverick's senior Africa reporter, Simon Allison.
And, nice to be here.
And Daily Maverick journalist, Greg Nicholson. Welcome you all to
nice
the show.
Nice to be back.
Fantastic. Yeah, Greg's no foreigner to the show here. So first, I actually want to dig into what you've been working on, Simon. A big news story that you very recently broke about what's being seen as the first South African who seems to be a part of ISIS. And I mean, I'm first just really curious as to how you stumbled upon this, Simon. How do we get to knowing about this?
It's been a long process, I think. What I've realized after sort of 3 or 4 years of doing this job is a lot of journalism is about the work you've done before. It's not really, you know, you can't just wake up one morning and decide to investigate a story and then find the leads, find the sources, etc. So I have been working on, you know, as an Africa reporter, I've done a lot of work around Islamist groups in Africa. So a lot of stuff on Al-Shabaab, on Boko Haram, and increasingly over the last year or so on Islamic State and the impact that they may or may not be having in Africa. And then I think because of that sort of body of work, people started to take me a little bit more seriously when it comes to these issues. And I've been able to make some contacts in companies and think tanks and that kind of thing. And then one of my contacts approached me and said that they're a private research organization and they research into terrorist groups specifically. And then they sell that research onto companies, interested individuals, possibly other intelligence services. I don't know. But they contacted me and said, look, they've been looking for ages at South Africa to see if there's any activity sort of on their radar. They haven't found any until now. And they found this guy who calls himself Abu Huraira on Twitter and on Tumblr. So these were public accounts. This guy wasn't hiding. And they said, look, you know, do you want to follow it up? And they gave me the tip-off, which was very kind of them. And then I followed it up with him.
There was the guy on Twitter?
First on Twitter, and he completely ignored me. And then there was, on his Tumblr account, there was a username for a social messaging application. No, not WhatsApp, but one of the other ones. So I just started messaging
Tinder.
Him on that. Grindr. and I started messaging him on that, and it took a little while. He wasn't really willing to be drawn out too much. He was very wary about who I was. Was I a Muslim? Why did I care?
Yeah.
That kind of thing. And I didn't lie to him, so I said I wasn't a Muslim. But he wasn't too keen on talking to me. And then eventually I wrote to him and said, look, you know, I'm a journalist. I will be writing about your social media accounts. And I want to make sure that it's a balanced portrayal, that I provide both perspectives, you know, that as your job as a journalist is to make sure you get both sides of the story. And this is what I was using as sort of bait. Please, if I don't get your side of the story, I can't publish your side of the story. And then he came back and he said, okay, we can talk. And then that's when I started the interview properly, you know, asking him what life was like, why he decided to do what he did, what his family thinks, where he thinks the whole ISIS thing is going, all that kind of stuff. So it was a really fascinating conversation.
Wow. So we have somebody who was born and raised in South Africa. And he, on his own accord, traveled to Syria to join the ISIS. Is that the general?
Basically. No, of course, we have to take everything with a pinch of salt.
Yep.
Okay. So we're very careful in the article to say, is this the first South African fighting for ISIS? Because we live in the age of Photoshop and VPNs where you can disguise your online identity. And it is certainly possible that someone could have faked or forged all the sort of online evidence and documentary evidence he provided. However, our assessment of the situation, looking at the information he gave us, and also looking at, you know, so I pressed him on stuff. You know, I wanted him to give me his Turkish, his entry into Turkey.
Mm.
His entry stamp and his passport, okay. You know. And he was able to give that to me within 15 minutes. I think it would have been quite hard to
fake that.
It doesn't show the sure. What he gave doesn't show any signs of being photoshopped, you know. So that kind of quick response makes me think that the story he's telling is legit. I think we are looking at one of the first South Africans in Syria fighting for the Islamic State, and not the only one. So Abu Huraira claims that there's another guy, Abu Barra, who's there with him. Since I published the story, I've been approached by a couple of people to say, hey, there's a few more. It's not just them. And last year, the Iraqi ambassador to South Africa, he came out and said, you know what, there's actually a bunch of South Africans in Syria and Iraq, and a bunch of them have died in battle already. And he was sort of blaming and castigating the government, saying, why aren't you doing something to stop them? And everyone dismissed this poor Iraqi ambassador, saying, no, you know, you're making stuff up. You're just trying to get some attention. So, yeah.
Sam, do you tell you much about his motives for trying to join ISIS, or that he claims he's joining ISIS, and his life in South Africa? Why would a guy, you know, who just, you know, lives in, I don't know, let's say Joburg or Durban or wherever he's from, just up and go to Syria?
It's a good question. I asked him, and what I got back was couched very much in religious language. So what he was saying was, this is the duty of every Muslim. And my understanding of the way Islam works is that if there is a caliphate, which has been declared in the Islamic State, so they've declared a caliphate, if there is a caliphate, it is every Muslim's duty to go and join that caliphate, to go and fight for that caliphate. So he was just responding to his religious duty to join the caliphate. Now, of course, the big problem here is this a real caliphate? And I think by far the majority of Muslims do not believe that this caliphate is in any way legitimate. But this guy does, and that's what he was saying. And that's a big part of what he was saying to other South African Muslims was, you have a duty to leave South Africa and come and fight with me, because that is your religious obligation.
Simon, the one thing that I found extremely interesting about your article when reading through it, as I said, you know, earlier in our brief chat earlier, is that, I mean, looking at the story, looking at the evidence that you gathered, it seems like a legitimate story. However, in your article, throughout the article, you've been placing what I can simply frame as disclaimers almost, mm-hmm. saying that, look, we can't confirm this and we can't confirm that. And obviously, I understand why mm-hmm. this is information you're getting from one source only. But in as much as that is the case, have you picked up a lot of flack since then? I mean, I know that yes. a number of people have been... I'm sure your phone has been ringing quite a bit since yesterday.
Yes, it has. The sort of flack has come in two main parts. Mm-hmm. One is, why did you publish this when you can't be 100%
okay.
accurate that he is who he says he is? And okay. and it's a valid question. And we grappled with it before we published it. And ultimately what we decided is that... even if this guy is a hoaxer, right? Mm. If he is a hoaxer, it's an extremely elaborate hoax.
Very much so. He
would have had to put a lot of time and effort and resources into it, which suggests that there may be a sustained or some kind of campaign to introduce Islamic State propaganda in South Africa, which is an important story in itself.
Or this guy's a real loser.
Or this guy's a real loser, exactly.
Too much time on his
head. Exactly. And if he's not a hoaxer, I mean, the public interest benefit of revealing what he's saying, I think, is self-evident, because if we don't know about the threat of ISIS propaganda in South Africa, then we can't defend ourselves against it. And certainly in my dealings with intelligence services about this, you know, I would phone and ask for comment and stuff. They had no idea what was going on, and they didn't seem to have that much interest, and that's been backed up by several other people dealing with it. This is not considered a big issue for state security agency. So I think by raising it, it may push the issue a little bit higher up on the agenda. The other critique that we received was that we were doing ISIS's propaganda for them. We were just, you know, being used as like a mouthpiece.
Yeah.
And I get that, because, you know, without our article, however many people read our article wouldn't have read those words. But at the same time, those words were accompanied with quite strong alternative descriptions of what the Islamic State is really like.
Exactly.
How they treat women, how they treat opponents, the incredibly brutal means of punishment they use, such as crucifixion, etc. So I think anyone who'd read the whole article, I don't buy the propaganda piece. I think if you read that article and you take away the Islamic State propaganda from it only, you are always going to be taking away the Islamic State propaganda.
But it's very simple. I mean, because then CNN is buying into the propaganda. Because I mean, every single time we see one of those horrible videos being released, we have a lengthy statement coming through from ISIS explaining why they're doing this. This guy's a Christian, and we decided to crucify him. Mm. Or he's a Jordanian pilot. He's the lowest of the low in terms of Islam, and therefore we're going to set him alight. So, you know, I don't necessarily get that critique in itself. My final one on this is, I mean, has there been backlash where people are saying, but hang on, you're just spreading rumor. You're just, you know, you're taking this a bit too far. This is sensationalist. You fear-mongering. Has any of that come up?
A couple of times, yes. But again, I don't think so. I think that the story is in the public interest. And I feel pretty comfortable with that at the end of the day.
Simon, we saw recently a story where the South African government, and I think it was a minister, condemned South African mercenaries who have gone to Nigeria to train the Nigerian army to fight Boko Haram, which actually you'd think seems like a good cause. they don't seem to be, you know, Boko Haram don't seem to be the nicest sort of guys, and the Nigerian army seem to need help. But they were condemned for that. And then the government seems to be so quiet on the idea of South Africans going to join ISIS. Why do you think there's a gap and difference? Is it just because it's confirmed that South African mercenaries have gone to Nigeria?
I think the Nigerian story, it was confirmed that there were South African mercenaries there, and then the government condemned it. This one, the government doesn't know anything about it themselves. Having said that, they did still condemn the possibility of anyone joining ISIS. They were very clear that anyone going to Syria to fight for ISIS or anyone else is violating the law and will be prosecuted.
Because it's illegal under South African law to get involved in other countries.
Which is ironic because we are one of the, you know, I think we're the greatest exporter of mercenaries in the world.
Right.
But it is still highly illegal.
Contractors,
we call them now.
They're security guards, not
mercenaries. Yeah, security guards. There we go.
And they sometimes shoot at each other.
Simon, you mentioned that Abu Huraya had some kind of call to action in his social media accounts and in your conversations with him. Do you think his message might appeal to any maybe young or naive people who maybe are looking for something to get involved in or looking to get behind a cause like ISIS?
Look, the only thing we have to go on this is how effective ISIS propaganda has been in other countries.
Yeah.
And if you look at the numbers of foreign fighters that have come from Europe, come from North America, come from other countries in the Middle East, we're talking tens of thousands of foreign fighters who have bought into this propaganda. So, yes, I don't see why South Africa is so different that we're not going to see another example of someone trying to join them. Having said that, we must be careful not to, you know, overstate this point. You know, I'm thinking, you know, we're talking in the ones or twos, maybe fives or sixes. We're not talking in the hundreds and thousands.
Yeah.
This isn't a existential crisis for the South African Muslim community because by and large, they are very moderate, very tolerant, and very well integrated into South African society.
Mm.
Absolutely. I mean, Simon, you've mentioned how successful ISIS has been at their sort of propaganda efforts. I mean, it's been hardly 2 years since we first heard of ISIS. And what are they doing differently? How have they been able to grow to such a force in such a short time?
Well, it's one of the great ironies is that they have manipulated the modern technology that they hate to spread their message. You know, ISIS doesn't like the internet or radio or any of these things because they are deemed as, you know, Western and not traditional and far too modern. But yet they have harnessed this technology as a weapon. So it's almost like they're using our own weapons against us.
Mm.
And it's quite extraordinary. And they have really done well on social media and these videos. You know, Gershwal mentioned them.
Talking about those videos, I mean, the thing what I find extremely surprising about the videos is that there's a production quality to them. In other words, it is a production that's put together.
It's very professional.
You know, and the sad thing is, I mean, I think it was the Jordanian pilot when he was set alight. There were still negotiations going on. turns out that this guy had probably already been killed while negotiations were going on. So they don't negotiate in good faith.
No.
The Japanese journalist, at least one of those beheadings had happened before negotiations had reached a point, you know, a stalemate point. I know that the Japanese government was extremely hard and said, no, we're not going to negotiate, you know, on your terms.
Yeah.
But the point is that so much effort goes into these videos that they come out a month after the event, which tells you something. These guys are really good at spreading a message.
Absolutely. On that note, that the most recent video, one of them, was the 21 Libyans. No, sorry, there were 21 Egyptians who were beheaded in Libya. And they were beheaded simultaneously on a beach. Right, and it was really graphic, horrible stuff. One of my contacts is working on this now, and she says that she's pretty sure that it was shot against a green screen. So it wasn't shot at a beach.
I've heard of some of their other footage being taken against green screens as
so,
well.
So I mean, and imagine that, you know, and talk about production values. They've got someone who can manipulate CGI and green screens and all that kind of technology.
That's crazy.
That's crazy. This is highly, highly skilled stuff, and it's good enough to fool most news agencies, you know.
Jihadi John, I mean, how much information were they able to extract from those videos?
Yeah,
you know, about Jihadi John, who he is, where he's from, based on his accent. I mean, there's a lot of intelligence that goes into those videos, and I presume that is why now they're resorting to stuff like green screen.
Yeah.
Because that way you can't sort of figure out where's the exact location.
That's a good
what
point,
is the height
actually.
Of the guy?
Oh, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. I mean, it was, and the reason why I know so much about this stuff, a lot of late night radio. So what does CNN
YouTube?
Cover?
Yeah.
What does CNN? No, funny enough, I'm one of those guys. I'm extremely averse to the photos and the videos.
Absolutely.
I fundamentally believe that, and then at least no one in this room would do this. You're far too professional for that. I can't stand people that would take the photos and the videos and share it via their social media pages. Because then you become ISIS and you spreading their message.
And it's horrible.
It's horrible. Horrific. I mean, why would you want to see someone's head being
chopped? On my Twitter timeline, was it the Jordanian pilot? The one who was set alight in a cage.
Hmm?
Just seeing the still image of him in that cage with the fire coming up, it's horrific. It's absolutely horrific. So, I mean, do you think some of this stuff, so with all these videos and things like that, could have this level and display of such graphic violence contributed to the South African going to join ISIS if he did?
It is a big part of their message. So when about 2 years ago, when ISIS is an offshoot of Al-Qaeda.
Yeah.
Roughly, it's very complicated, but you know, they started in roughly the same place. And then eventually Al-Qaeda essentially excommunicated ISIS. And Zawahiri, the Al-Qaeda leader, wrote a letter to the ISIS leader saying, you guys are too barbaric, you are too brutal, and your brutality is going to hurt the cause. He tried to phrase it in very practical, you know, there's going to be counterproductive, that's the word I'm looking for. And ISIS said, no, this is the way. And they carried on. And you know what? They were right. That's the horrific thing. Since they decided that, since they broke with Al-Qaeda, since they embraced extreme violence, extremely graphic and extremely public violence, they have gone from strength to strength, not only where they live, where they are based, but in lots of places across the world. Mm. And it's quite horrendous. And you start wondering about humanity. Is there something about this violence that we are inherently attracted to?
Just one question. I mean, and this is a question I've heard many people asking, many analysts have answered on this one. Maybe I'm putting you in a bit of a tough spot here, Simon, but we see them in Libya, or at least that's, you know, green screen or no green screen. Those were 21 Egyptian Coptic Christians still on the African continent. We have groups like Boko Haram and Al-Shabaab, Boko Haram more particularly, saying that, hey, you know what, we welcome ISIS and we're going to lend a helping hand.
Yeah.
You have Al-Shabaab in East Africa saying that, you know what, we're affiliated to Al-Qaeda. I don't know whether they would necessarily want to affiliate themselves with ISIS more specifically, but do you think that we're going to see a greater spread and infiltration of ISIS across the African continent, especially based on the fact that we're having so much insecurity and instability across the continent at the moment?
In short, yes. And the reason for that, the way to think about terrorist groups expanding is not like ISIS itself sending a bunch of ISIS members to Libya and they're sort of taking over and Libya becomes part of its territory. That isn't how it works. How it works is a militia group in Libya says, you know what, we're going to see if we can make a partnership with ISIS, almost like a franchise operation. You know, some people set up KFCs, some people set up ISIS affiliate.
Yeah.
I'm in the KFC front personally, but and so what happened in Libya was an Islamist, I think a couple of Islamist militias there, they've donned the sort of cloak of ISIS. Okay. And it works for them both, because this like small irrelevant militia group now can say, ah, we are ISIS, you know, and they become much more dangerous, much more threatening. And then ISIS can say, ah, we're now in Libya and we weren't there before. So they become much more dangerous and much more threatening. So it's like a win-win for everyone. But really, the biggest impact it's going to have, even with people, so Al-Shabaab, I think it's unlikely that they're going to go with ISIS at any point, because they're pretty solid in there with Al-Qaeda, and it's hard to switch between the two. Nonetheless, Al-Shabaab is going to start copying ISIS's tactics. And that's the real problem we have, is that ISIS's tactics have been so incredibly effective that terror groups everywhere, no matter their affiliation, are going to start mimicking them. And we saw this recently. Al-Shabaab released a 67-minute-long video in which they threatened to bomb two malls in London, one mall in New York, a mall somewhere else.
Wait. So Al-Shabaab is now going international as well. They're exporting.
Al-Shabaab are now going. Al-Shabaab, what Al-Shabaab are doing is they're using the same propaganda tools. And they could well, and I think part of that will be to start doing more graphic, more brutal kind of attacks captured on camera to then export to the world to make yourself look a lot bigger and scarier.
Simon, please explain to me how Boko Haram plays into this on their what's happening locally in Nigeria. How does Boko Haram join?
So Boko Haram, interesting. Boko Haram are very much rooted in the local politics of that region, in the history of that region. And they were quite slow to tap into the whole global jihadi network. And even now, what they've said is that they have declared their own territory, which they control in northeastern Nigeria, and it's the size of Belgium or something. I mean, we're talking big area. At the same time, what they've done is they've declared that to be, it's quite technical, they've said it is part of an Islamic caliphate.
Okay.
Now, there is only one Islamic caliphate at the moment in operation, and that is the ISIS caliphate. Yeah. Yet, Boko Haram has not pledged bayah, which is official allegiance, to Baghdadi, who is the head, who is the caliph. And that's what you have to do. You have to pledge allegiance to the individual himself.
And that makes it one caliphate.
And then what that means is that once Boko Haram pledged allegiance, Boko Haram have to listen to anything Baghdadi says. So the minute they pledge allegiance, they effectively cede control to the caliph himself, right? So what they're doing now is they're putting themselves in the ISIS orbit while keeping control of the day-to-day operations.
Do you think they'll ever pledge allegiance?
They might. I think it depends on what ISIS can offer. So if ISIS is in a position... So in Libya, I think ISIS was in a position to say, we can help you with weapons and funds, etc. Because the links between Libya and Syria are quite strong.
Yeah.
Nigeria is a different kettle of fish. That's a lot further away, a lot harder to get to. I think there's very little direct assistance that ISIS can actually offer. So until they can have a bigger carrot, I think we're unlikely to see a pledge of allegiance from Boko Haram.
Well, so what we're seeing basically is we're seeing ISIS positioning themselves as the extreme of the extremists and setting the pace in that direction.
Exactly.
And also using propaganda.
The same way that the Republican Tea Party pulls everyone else right wing, ISIS is pulling all the terrorist organizations even further.
Republican Tea Party. Interesting one there.
Let's just start on the Tea Party.
Yeah, if we want to talk about extremists.
And I think one thing that I've been really trying to grapple with is what you really brought up is how on earth does this play into to what we've been monitoring on the ground in Nigeria? I mean, you've been writing a lot about the local elections and Boko Haram. And I think in its own vacuum, that's something that I feel sort of quote unquote made sense in the issues with the North and South and Boko Haram. And when you bring ISIS into play and then Al-Shabaab is into play.
ISIS just messes everything up for everyone.
Nigeria is hard enough to understand as it is.
You know, the real problem we have now, so the Libyan government, what remains of it, you know, the tiny shell of a government in Tobruk, has appealed to the international community and said, we need weapons. We can't fight these guys without weapons. And of course they can't, you know. ISIS is well armed. They're well equipped. The ISIS groups in Libya, they have some serious stuff. But the international community can't give them weapons because this government can't be trusted. And they can't know that the weapons won't fall into the hands of ISIS. And same in Nigeria. No one wants to give Nigeria weapons because who knows what they're going to do with them. So we're in this real catch-22 where we have this problem, but we also have no one who has enough authority to deal with the problem.
But in Nigeria's case, doesn't that seem crazy considering it's the biggest economy on the whole continent?
With a legitimate government in place.
Well, yeah.
legitimate.
And they can't buy arms.
Don't you think, though, that part of the problem, I mean, if you look at it, especially the issue of terrorism on the African continent, whether you're talking Libya, Nigeria, or East Africa, that the issue boils down to poor governance. That you're running a country and parts of that country you have no darn control over whatsoever. And then, I mean, really, I mean, now we're turning back and we're looking at the African Union, we're looking at the UN, we're looking towards the US. And let's be honest, Greg, the moment you start flying in American fighter jets to take out ISIS, Boko Haram, Al-Shabaab, you know, you have your pick. Then suddenly, oh, no, the West is trying to, colonize us again and, you know, stuff these guys, we don't like them, blah, blah, blah. I mean, that type of sentiment comes out. So what, you know, damned if you do, damned if you don't.
But then in this case, we're not talking about a case like Libya where foreign troops or, you know, foreign planes sort of bombed the hell out of Libya. We're talking about just sending guns and things like that.
Sure.
Which still, if you give a whole bunch of weapons to Nigeria's army, it could end up in the hands of Boko Haram, couldn't it? And then also they can commit their own atrocities.
Most of the weapons that ISIS has in Syria and Iraq are American, taken from the Iraqi army. So if America hadn't armed the Iraqi army, ISIS would be a lot less strong than it is now. But at the same time, if they hadn't armed the Iraqi army, the government wouldn't have been able to have any control whatsoever. So I have no solutions. Absolutely none.
You're the go-to guy.
I look at this situation.
This is Simon, fix it now.
I look at the situation and I just think, we're in serious shit.
We have seen some rumblings. I think, Greg, you were saying earlier that New Zealand has sent some forces.
It's 150-odd non-combative troops to train the Iraqi army, haven't they? The Kiwis are sending some troops.
Must be really serious if the Kiwis are getting involved.
It's 150 non-combative troops.
I mean,
they're just symbolic.
Yeah, that's right. But I was wondering, how long have other foreign Western forces been in Iraq, as well as Afghanistan, trying to train their local armies? And how well has that gone? Now we get 150 troops from New Zealand just trying to chip in and see what they can do. I'm not so confident it's going to make any sort of difference.
What I'm starting to wonder is you know, we do tend to approach this problem through a very state-centric lens, you know. Boko Haram in Nigeria is a good example. So it's a Nigeria, we think it's a country, so the government in Lagos must have full control over the whole country. Yeah. And if it doesn't, we've got to find a way to make sure it does. So we got to, you know, they've got to go to war, they've got to, you know, maybe it's not meant to be a one whole country. Maybe there should be a separate state in northeastern Nigeria that operates under different laws.
I mean, in East Africa, we saw that play in Sudan. Are we trying to force this to be one country?
One country, exactly.
And
Can I just ask one question? Because I'm, you know, a very long time ago when I was a law student, and that's years ago.
Yeah, I was
many alcoholic drinks later. I remember that there was this issue in terms of international law where secession is not necessarily the way to go. Where if you have a country, if borders have been drawn, so in other words, the borders that we inherited from the First World War, going into the Second World War and after that, need to stay that way. And it makes sense to some extent, because if you come back to South Africa, there's a bunch of very interesting people that every now and again, every October, release red balloons, and they feel that they need to have a state of their own.
Yeah.
So what I'm saying is, if we're going to secede every single time, then everyone can start up their own country. ISIS, at the moment, is trying to start up their own country. Mm. That's why it's called Islamic State. So what I'm saying is that in as much as that might seem to be the immediate solution, if you look at Sudan right now, South Sudan, it's still a mess.
It hasn't worked, has it?
It hasn't worked. So it's definitely not the way to... I do say that maybe, Mr. Goodluck, Jonathan Goodluck, that it's about time that you bolstered your army, got serious about governance, and actually said that, you know, northeastern Nigeria is part of this country I'm in charge of.
Mm.
You can't sort of just, you know, those people, shame in, you know, 2,000 of them died today. Vote me in. I'll do something about it, guys. But until then, good luck. Doesn't work like it.
Okay, I think final word, please, on Nigeria before we go into the break. Simon, we have this Boko Haram issue, but simultaneously Nigeria is trying to hold their democratic elections. So what kind of situation is the Nigerian government in?
It's in a pickle.
Okay.
A pickle.
Yeah. Pickle. Very delicate pickle. I think that so they were meant to have the elections on Valentine's Day, 14th of February. They delayed them by 6 weeks till March 28th to deal with the security situation, as if an extra 6 weeks is going to make all the difference. But in that 6 weeks, we've seen all kinds of amazing victories for the Nigerian army. They've taken back towns. They've killed hundreds of militants. We don't know if that's true or not. And there's no one who can tell us if it's true or not, because there's no real journalism going on in those areas because it's simply too dangerous. So what it seems now is that the war against Boko Haram is actually a campaign tool, which is a really frightening thing, because then what happens when the election is won?
Absolutely.
Then no one really cares about the war and Boko Haram anymore. And one thing that was really interesting to me, I was speaking to some businessmen at a sort of investment forum last year, and I said, what country would you most like to invest in if you had your own money?
Yeah.
You know, they all said Nigeria. Mm. You know, amazing growth, GDP's expanding, the market's huge.
Yeah. Growing,
like,
middle
but
class.
What about the situation in the, you know, the security situation? Yeah. They're like, it's in the northeast. It has no impact on Lagos.
And that seems to be the government's perspective
as
well.
That seems to be the government's perspective.
It's too far from Abuja and Lagos.
Yeah. Northeast, they can do whatever
North
they
want. Northeast, they'll just, you know, as long as not a political, it doesn't hurt their own immediate political prospects, then they don't need to deal with it.
Wow. Okay, guys, we need to go into a break now. That's it for the first portion of our show. We'll continue to monitor extremism across the continent as well, with an eye on the upcoming Lesotho elections, the Nigerian elections, and I'm sure there'll be a lot to come in the coming weeks. Over the break, please make sure to tweet us at cliffcentral.com and at Daily Maverick. See you in a bit.
Stay informed and up to date. It's the Daily Maverick Show, Tuesdays 1 to 2 p.m. on cliffcentral.com.
You're tuning into the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. We are now going to bring things local and talk a bit about the state of politics in South Africa. So just quickly to set the scene, at the end of the State of the Nation address, I think everybody was a bit in shock. So we had the fracas in Parliament. We had the cell phone jamming. We had the quote unquote waiters who came into Parliament and politely escorted members of the opposition out. So that's how we went to the Sona debate. And it's quite interesting how things played out. Any highlights or surprises from you guys from the Sona debate?
Sort of I think the highlight of the debate for me, and I think a lot of people, has to be Zuma's reply. Yeah. Zuma was on the back foot after what happened during the State of the Nation address, where the EFF got kicked out. No one listened to his speech. The whole focus was on the EFF's eviction and police coming into the house and the signal jamming that prevented journalists briefly doing their work. So it was all about controversy, all about what sort of looked to be South Africa moving towards being a security state, if we just take this example.
And then
during the debate, we had 2 days of opposition ANC and opposition MPs, particularly with the opposition MPs, really, really dig into Zuma. If we particularly look at Musi Maimane with his killer statements.
He was having a moment of glory.
Yeah, that strong speech where he said, Zuma is a broken man presiding over a broken society. It was pretty cutting. and meanwhile, the whole state security thing and the whole jamming thing is still rolling on. Zuma comes up for the State of the Nation debate reply on, I think it was last Thursday, and no one knows what he's going to say, no one knows whether he's going to hit back at anyone, no one knows what's going to happen. He comes up, and he largely sort of almost clicked reset. He almost just set things back to normal. All of a sudden, his speech took the heat, really, out of everything that happened over the last week, and he acknowledged opposition leaders. Sort of looked like a gesture of reconciliation, but also just by him stepping up and acknowledging these guys, except for Musi Maimane, of course, which is sort of the one issue. Even Julius Malema, he said, you know, it's great you could give a speech without having to yell and, you know, create chaos, because no one can hear you when you create chaos and things like that. He acknowledged all the opposition leaders and really sort of stepped up as a statesman. And then I think the moment when things changed was when he was speaking to, he addressed a point raised by Peter Mulder, who's head of Freedom Front Plus.
Yeah.
Mulder had said in his reply that the ANC and Zuma essentially scaring white people and Afrikaners out of the country and trying to blame South Africa's problems on apartheid and on them. Zuma then went into a lengthy history lesson, going basically from Jan van Riebeek's time, before him even.
Wow.
It took like half an hour. He went on for so long, and he schooled Mulder.
Okay.
He really did. he just said, and he kept on saying, this is the facts. He just said, because he was saying, all the problems started when van Riebeek came. He was saying, we're not blaming you or anything like that, but we have to acknowledge history.
The facts are the facts.
And he said all these things. People were chased off their lands. There were the Fort Trekkers who moved into, you know, here. We had the Boer Republics. So we had all this sort of stuff. And all these things happened, and African, black Africans were oppressed. And that created many problems. And there, he just sort of laid it out flat. And he was enjoying himself. He was really really loving it. And obviously the Freedom Front Plus doesn't have a whole lot of supporters in the house. So everyone else was enjoying it. And I think that really gave him the confidence to just sort of take this, sort of take the political situation at the moment, sort of by the horns, and stamp his authority on it. He actually looked like a statesman for once.
I'm slightly worried. I think that we might have a president that's on lithium. I'll tell you why. on day one, with the actual sonar, we saw the schoolyard bully. He was laughing and he was giggling while the waiters stormed in, or walked in politely and beat everyone out of parliament, right? And then after that, we saw, you know, when you jump into a pool, a really cold pool on a hot day, and your testes recede. You know that feeling that you get? That was day two. Or that was the, you know, when Musi climbed into him, when Julius climbed into him, when everyone basically climbed into him. And then day three, finally, he looked like a statesman. And in as much as people, but I'm really concerned though that in as much as we enamored with him again, in as much as now we're worried about poison plots against him by his wife or his wives.
What a story.
In as much as now everyone's sort of forgotten about the signal jamming, the police storming into the House of Parliament, I'm really concerned about the fact that now we're enamored with this president and now everyone's sort of back to business. Yes, no, he makes sense. He is measured. He answered and replied very well.
Yeah.
But the key point is he did all those things beforehand, guys. And it's something that I think we should not forget. And I think action needs to be taken for that. Because for me, it took the Constitution and chucked it out the window that day. And for me, that is a real concern because we still have another 4 years of this administration left.
But I think what we saw when Zuma gave his reply was perhaps why he was elected in the first place, back in 2009, and why he won at Polokwane earlier than that, is because when he does speak off the cuff and he speaks confidently, he is a very, very charismatic figure. And it certainly shouldn't wipe away any of the many wrongs he's accused of.
Yeah.
But you got a sense on that day as to how he maintains his leadership and strength and power, and how I think he can still be loved by so many people despite the scandals that are continuing to swirl around him.
Well, charisma is more powerful than policy or actions, I think. I think, you know, look at Barack Obama as a good example of someone whose policies haven't actually been that much different to what came before, and yet he's Barack Obama, and we love him because he can deliver a really fantastic speech. And Julius Malema, another great example of someone whose policies are largely meaningless a lot of the time, but yet he can enthrall, and he can speak to people. And when Zuma gets into that stride, then suddenly everything he's done just recedes into the background.
I get that, and don't get me wrong. I think that up until Sona, you know, there's been many complaints and many allegations and all kinds of nonsense going on. Let's be honest, there's rape allegations and this, that, and the other. And every now and again people mention, I mean, even in my column on Sona, made it clear that forget the fact that he's a polygamist. Forget the fact that there's all this other stuff. He is our president at the moment. That's what our focus needs to be on. We really need to focus on what he's done in the previous five years and what he's doing in the next 5 years after that. What I'm really concerned by is the fact that when you take the Constitution and you throw it out the window, and that's what happened on that day. There's no two ways about it. Then we need to start holding power to account. No matter how charming he is. Because, you know, unfortunately, guys that beat the living daylights out of their wives are very charming guys themselves. Mm. You know, the day after they buy the roses and they buy the chocolates and they say they'll never do it again and they cry and they do all kinds. You know, and go and watch 50 Shades of Grey, for goodness sake, you know?
But so the problem is how do we do it? Because when it comes to the next election and the ANC gets voted in again, It's almost an endorsement of that.
But can you see what my problem is? Is that it's also part of the South African thinking, is we're waiting for the next elections to come. Mm. That's not how it's supposed to work. Constitutionality needs to be protected throughout, you know, the term. So I'm not too sure exactly myself, Simon. I know maybe I should know this, but I'm surely someone, and I know, you know.
Today we seem to be good at raising problems. And we're not so hot with solutions.
No, but what I'm saying is someone needs to take this matter through to at least the Constitutional Court. I know that the Human Rights Commission is looking into one or two of these things. A finding needs to be made, and it needs to be held to. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it needs to be started.
You are absolutely
right. What I'm just saying is that I think as a citizenry, whether it's the opposition, and I couldn't care less who does this, but someone needs to take this a step further. But
I don't think people are just sitting on their hands and sort of saying, look, he violated the rules of Parliament and the Constitution. Well, the ANC and the presiding officers of Parliament, you know, there's no one who can really put the finger on and said they've completely done the wrong thing yet, you know, except for perhaps the National Intelligence Agency that the Parliament has admitted that jammed the signal.
Yeah.
But people have gone to court. They went to court on the signal jamming issue. They went to court on the issue of the parliamentary feed, the TV channel not showing the ruckus in Parliament. And there looks like and seems to be other court action going on with some of the police officers entering the house. So I think we often in South African society, we jump to the courts quite quickly, and I think it's a good thing. It can be a negative thing sometimes, but people do take action. I think the difficult thing with President Zuma and the ANC as it is under President Zuma, just like this conversation, we jump between either scandal, so it's either Nkandla, it's either his corruption charges, it's either the rape case, or any of these, or Parliament as it was, or that, oh, it's okay now, he seems a bit better, or the ANC is doing a bit better. Yep. We seem to either jump between the two, and then in between, I think we often struggle to actually make sure that the state is working, looking at actual state policies and ensuring that state-owned enterprises are running, although there is quite a focus on them. And we fail to ensure that the rule of law is really taking place.
So I think we need lithium.
Maybe just help us all, huh?
Just ask Zuma's wife. I'm sure she can provide.
Okay, guys, this one is be coming up a bit. So, okay, let's give this no more than 1 minute. Should we pay any attention to the allegations that Zuma was poisoned by his wife? Is there any merit here? Legitimate story? Is this worth paying any attention?
Can I say no?
Yeah.
Obviously we have to. There's reports that the president's wife tried to poison him. Like, I don't think we can ignore it, but I think there are also other things going on, which this particular wife was already, she was being, there are reports that she was being pushed out of sort of the presidency and her and the home she was staying in, things like that. So there are other things going on in there, and so obviously we have to take into account, and if it does turn out to be true, it's a very serious issue, and it's quite worrying that this guy's our president, if his wife's trying to kill him.
although the timing does seem suspicious, because suddenly all the attention is off Sona, and it's on this plot where Zuma is the victim and not the perpetrator for once.
And we're not talking about the rumors and allegations that his wife was perhaps cheating on him as well. So,
I mean, but as assuming this is a plot to take the attention off Sona, does this bode well for the president? It seems that he didn't particularly know he was poisoned, and his medical team didn't know, and it was discovered in America. And it was in Russia. Yeah. I think it was both. I'm not sure.
Both. Yeah.
I think it was both.
Yeah.
It was both. Okay, so he got.
He didn't believe the Americans, then he went to the Russians.
So, I mean, it sounds more ridiculous than anything else.
No,
or maybe that's
it. I have this image of, like, some medieval food. You know, the kings used to have food tasters. Is Zuma going to have one of those from now on?
Maggie. Yeah. just check out this long stale for me.
Maybe that's how he keeps control of cabinet, you know?
If we see someone rise very quickly, you know, to a ministerial position or something like that.
That's the food test.
Maybe we know, yeah.
Back to the Sona debate, I think there were
other issues raised apart from Zuma's reply and Musi Maimane's scathing response. One of the highlights for me, just because it was so funny, was the Higher Education Minister Bladen Zamandis. He finished off the debates for the ANC, and he's like the king of one-liners. Do you remember when the Democratic Alliance turned up to Sona all wearing black?
Yeah.
First of all, he said, "Oh, I thought I arrived on the scene of a Dracula movie." then he said, right. "You must never wear black in this house again, unless you're at the funeral of white minority rule." Oh. he was on fire. And yeah, then he says to Julius Malema, "Don't start something in this house that you can't finish."
Oh, yeah.
And obviously, Julius gets outraged. That's a threat. And there's a little bit of a standoff again in Parliament. But for entertainment value, it was gold.
10 out of 10.
I loved it.
Okay, so you weren't watching the Grammys. You were squarely on the
surface. This is more exciting. You were,
but where's the conversation on policy? I mean, there was some conversations about the land holdings bill, but that seemed to be more like a conversation about who owns the Freedom Charter, really. Julius seems to want royalties for any mention or application of the Freedom Charter. And so still, we're not talking about the bill.
There was some discussion on that. Okay, good. At least Jacob Zuma cleared up that, well, we still don't know the specific details, you know, because they say it's going to be worked out. But on the land holdings bill, which has been in the news because it could end up meaning that foreigners won't be able to own land, which is obviously quite a polemic issue. Zuma did say that it will be. I think it was Zuma that said that it will be. Well, anyway, it was one of the ANC members that said that no, it will apply to agricultural land, yeah, okay. And it will be over a certain number of hectares. So your random executive at Anglo American, who's now living in Johannesburg, I don't think they're going to take his Sandton house. You know?
But so, there was a very interesting conversation that followed that one in terms of Bekele's interpretation of what agricultural land is. And I think that what part of the problem is in the bill, which is another, you know, what I'm talking about in terms of maintaining the rule of law and constitutionality, is that it remains in the minister's discretion what is classified as agricultural land. Mm.
Which will obviously, I think, be tested under law.
Mm. Yeah.
If they publish it as that, it's obviously going to... They're going to either try to do something or someone will just take it to court.
Because going back to that example of that Anglo-American executive that maybe, I don't know, writes a funny op-ed in the Daily Maverick and then suddenly falls out of favor. Mm. Does his house in the middle or, you know, property in the middle of Sandton suddenly become agricultural land? You know? So obviously that's the type of protections that need to be built into this. Mm. I think that it needs a constitutionality test. I think all bills do, but
I think it'll be a long process with this one. Just considering how it's in such a heated environment. The land issue is a huge, huge issue. And there's also the issue of foreigners owning land, things like that, the Chinese coming in buying, you know, all over the world, buying agricultural land.
Well, the other bit on that was the limit on land purchases or land ownership to 12,000 hectares, which isn't that much. It's like a medium to large farm, but it's not, you know, a super big farm.
In terms of farmland.
So I haven't heard much about how that is going to be applied. Are big farming corporations going to have to downscale?
They'll have to lease their land.
So I think, and also there's the 50-50 ownership between the who are now the farm owners and the farm workers. Mm. So that's also something that's coming into play. Mm-hmm. But just quickly on that, the bill seems to want to apply that to long-term workers who've been there for a long time, which doesn't do very much because a lot of farm workers are seasonal and come in every now and then.
That's true.
So I think we're still seeing quite a few things with the land holdings bill that are not quite there yet. Gashwa.
Radical land change. Can I just mention one acronym?
Oh, boy.
EFF. For me, this is a response to the EFF. Yep. The EFF came out, they're radical. Sure. We're going to take the land. The ANC has been sitting since 1994 looking at the situation of land and not really doing much, not having made much progress in that field. So guess what? I guess someone at some stage said, you know, amongst the six NEC members, that guys, maybe we should start talking about this land thing
a little
more seriously.
And credit to the EFF for that.
Putting it on the agenda.
It's something that South Africa needs desperately, and if Julius can force things into action.
Yeah, for sure.
But now I think what has to happen is, because obviously the EFF's raised this very heated issue, and it's an issue that can get votes. By having a strong stance on the land issue, can get votes, and now we see the ANC responding by trying to take the action of their own. The worry is that we may not get something that's passed or comes through that's actually thought through well enough, you know.
Yeah.
We might just get, you know, the EFF's raised as the ANC in government. We also need to step up and do something on this issue and put through a bill that isn't thought through well enough. We need radical land transformation within the country. And I don't necessarily mean radical in the way Julius Malema sees it, but we need transformation in terms of ownership of the land. And we need that to be done properly and well, and it never has been in South Africa.
Greg, thank you for that. Unfortunately, we are now out of time. I think we need to really sort of set aside a whole hour for this topic. So maybe in the coming week we'll have a full sort of land dig in. Oh, pardon. Anyway, on that note, a big thank you to everyone in studio, Gushel Brooks, Simon Allison, Greg Nicholson. A big thank you, and we'll see you next week. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.